Shrimad Bhagavatam, 9.10.34, translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Upon reaching Ayodhya, Lord Ramchandra heard that in his absence his brother Bharata was eating barley cooked in the urine of a cow, covering his body with the bark of trees and wearing matted locks of hair and lying on a mattress of kusha. The most merciful Lord very much lamented this. There is no purport to this verse. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. So today morning I'll continue our discussion on Ram Leela. Yesterday we discussed about how there are two obstacles in the spiritual path. Broadly speaking, there is doubt and there is desire. Doubt is what checks us in moving towards Krishna, and desire is what drags us away from Krishna. So today on the Ramayana, we'll discuss about how the Lord tests our desires and how we can pass those tests. So after Lord Ram completed his exile for 14 years and he returned back. So at that time he came in the Pushpak Vahan, the airplane which Ravana had stolen from his brother Kuvera. And the Pushpak Vahan desired to do one last service. And Vibhishan also wanted to do one last service to the Lord. Vibhishan had been enthroned as the king. And when Bharat had parted from Ram, at that time Bharat had very strongly said, "Oh Ram, if you don't return in 14 years, if you return later than 14 years, then I will not be able to live without you." So the battle had gone on till almost the end of the 14 years. And so Lord Ram was concerned about how he will reach Ayodhya back in time. It had taken, initially when they had come, it had taken quite a substantial amount of time for them to walk from Kishkindha down to Lanka and then cross over the ocean. So at that time Vibhishan suggested, "Please take the Pushpaka Vahan." And then he took the Pushpaka Vahan, but Ram did not go straight to Ayodhya. While he was going along, he took all the Vanaras with him, not just Sugriva, but all the Vanaras who had been fighting. And then while he was going along, he told them that, "Now all of you deserve a reward. So there's going to be a big celebration in Ayodhya when the coronation will take place." So they got down at Kishkindha and he told them, "Get all your family with you. There's going to be a celebration, so all of you should get. So get your wives, get your children, get all your family members." And then they all ascended the Pushpaka Vahan and then they went towards Ayodhya. And again, when they were approaching Ayodhya, Lord Ram stopped. He stopped at the ashram of Bharadwaj. Lord Ram, the first sage whom he had met when he entered into the forest was Bharadwaj. And Bharadwaja suggested that you go and stay in Chitrakoot. Chitrakoot Adri Niketana Rama. Then Amaravayan stated that Lord Ram stayed at Chitrakoot. So after staying at Chitrakoot, Chitrakoot is very close to Ayodhya. From there he came to Nasik, and Nasik was the place where Sita was abducted. Now, when he came there, Bharadwaja Muni had requested that, please, when you return back to the kingdom, come to my hermitage. So Lord Ram obliged him. But there was one, he wanted to take the blessings of Bharadwaja Muni, but there was one more purpose. And when they landed at the Bharadwaja Muni's ashram, Ram told Hanuman, you please go ahead and inform Bharat that Ram has now finished his 14 years exile. He has rescued Sita, and now he's about to come back to the kingdom. And Ram told Hanuman, while you're telling this, observe Bharat very carefully. If you see the slightest hint of displeasure on his face, on hearing the news that I am coming back, then he says, I will not go back. He says, if he has, while living in the kingdom as the king, developed any attachment to the kingdom, if he wants the kingdom, then I do not want to take the kingdom that he wants away from him. So therefore, I will not go back. That was Lord Ram's decision. Now, Hanuman was very touched by this selflessness. Because if, assuming at this time, Bharat had wanted to take the kingdom, and Ram had brought all the Vanaras with him, all the families were there, and there was supposed to be a coronation. No coronation would take place. But Ram was concerned more about caring for Bharat's emotions and not so much for his own face and image. And then Hanuman went straight to Bharat, and he found to his surprise that Bharat was not living in the kingdom. Bharat was living on the outskirts of the kingdom of Ayodhya in a place called Nandigram. And there he had built a very simple hermitage. And he was living there in that hermitage. And as is mentioned in this verse, you know, he would eat very simple food. The kind of food that hermit living in the forest would eat. Now, barley is considered to be the simplest among all foods. Very simple. And then it would be soaked in cow urine. So that was the kind of food he was eating. And Bharat was also wearing the garb of a mendicant. And when Bharat saw this, saw Hanuman over there, so he asked, who are you? No, he had not met Hanuman before. There are later retellings of the Ramayana, such as the Ramcharitmanas, which state that Bharat and Hanuman had an encounter while Ram was going towards the Himalayan mountains to get some medicinal herbs. But the Valmiki Ramayana is silent about that kind of any encounter of that kind. So Bharat expresses surprise. Oh, who are you? And then he says, I am a servant of Ram. My name is Hanuman. And I have been sent as a messenger to inform you that Ram is preparing to come back to the kingdom. When Bharat just jumps up practically in joy, he says, this is the best news I have ever got. This is the news I have been anticipating for the last 14 years. Oh, mysterious being, whoever you are, monkey or celestial or God, you have brought the greatest happiness to my heart and my life. What reward can I give you? I can give you the royal treasury. I can give you a whole village. I can give you whatever you want. So seeing this overwhelming expression of joy on the face of Bharat, at that time, Hanuman, it's tears in his eyes. And he realizes that Bharat's devotion is actually no less than his own devotion for Ram. And he feels that Ram has no reason to doubt. Bharat has no desire for the kingdom at all. And then Hanuman goes back and assures Ram that Bharat is eagerly waiting for you to return. And when Ram comes in the Pushpaka Vahana. At that time, Bharat has arranged the whole royal assembly and the citizens of Ayodhya, all of them are there waiting. at the outskirts of the city. And when he sees the Pushpak Vahan coming from distance, right, seeing this Vahan itself, Bharat offers obeisances. And after offering obeisances, he starts doing Aarti of Ram. And Ram comes on the chariot and he embraces Bharat. Bharat falls at his feet. And that is the time when Ram sees Bharat is also wearing forest bark, tree bark, a dress made of tree bark, and he's also living like a mendicant. He asks, what happened? Why are you living like this? And then Bharat said, this is in service to you. So actually what had happened earlier was that when Bharat came to know what his mother Kaikeyi had done, he was horrified, he was appalled, he was pained beyond words. And he immediately decided to go to Ram. But in order to go to Ram, he decided to take his... Because he knew, because he was a younger brother, he couldn't persuade Ram. So he decided to take the whole family, take the sages, take the Brahmins, take the royal priest Vasishtha, and take leading representatives of all the citizens with him in order to go and beseech Ram to come back and accept the kingdom. And he knew that Ram would not so easily accept. So he said that, oh Ram, when finally he met Ram, he said, you know, our father's word should be honored, but he says, it is not your fault because of which my father had to give such a promise. It is because of my mother's fault. Therefore, I will atone for that. And I will live in the forest for 14 years in your place. You go back and rule the kingdom that belongs to you. So Ram told him, oh brother, now we all have to bear our own karma. Nobody can take anyone else's karma for them. If we all started taking each other's karma, then that would lead to chaos in the world. He says, the instruction to go to the forest had been given to me. Therefore, I will go to the forest. I will stay in the forest. So Bharat said that, if you do not go back to the kingdom, I cannot go back to the kingdom either. The kingdom does not belong to me. I will stay in this forest and I will sit here and in the kusha grass I will perform austerity till you accept the kingdom. And he sits down in the yogic mudra and starts performing austerity. This is actually at the climax of a long discussion. And when Bharat takes this apparently inflexible position, no more, I will not go back. So you know, the whole assembly that is there, it all becomes spellbound, silent. And then Ram gathers Bharat, picks him up and embraces him. And he says, oh Bharat, your love has won. Your love has won. You came to give me the kingdom. I accept the kingdom. Bharat's face blossoms in joy. But then Ram remains grave. And Ram says, I accept the kingdom that you give me. But I request that you allow me to honor my father's word. He wanted me to stay in the forest for 14 years. Therefore, during these 14 years, you look after the kingdom on my behalf. Now Bharat is completely outwitted. He has no more arguments left. Then he says, Oh Lord, if you are the ruler, then let the world know that you are the ruler and that I am simply a representative on your behalf. Therefore he says, you know, please put your footsteps on these sandals and give me those sandals. They will rule the kingdom. They will be the rulers and I'll be the representative. Now what was in his heart, Bharat wanted to have it demonstrated to the world. He thought of himself as the servant of the Lord, but he also wanted that to be demonstrated to the world. And thus, he would not sit at the throne, the sandals would sit at the throne. And he would sit at their foot and do the royal responsibilities. So, you know, Ram actually touched the sandals, put his foot in it, and then he gave that foot, those shoes, to Bharat. Now today, if two brothers have a succession conflict, and one brother gives his footwear to the other brother will probably take the shoes and beat his brother with the head, you know, with that. But that is the extent of selflessness of Bharat. Bharat accepted all the responsibilities of the throne without taking any of the privileges of the throne. Today's politicians are often exactly the opposite. They want all the privileges without the responsibilities. You know, in India, often the politicians are known to be very acrimonious. You know, they quarrel and fight. It's almost like a street fight going on sometimes in the assemblies. They have strong, violent conflicts over almost all resolutions. But every assembly that has passed on till now, in almost every assembly, they've always passed one resolution unanimously. That resolution is to increase the post-retirement benefits of those MLAs or MPs. They are unanimous. Okay, we got some privileges now. We want these privileges to continue afterwards also. So, Ram's attitude is, Bharat's attitude is exactly the opposite, that he wants to do the service. So, Ram basically tests the desire of Bharat. Does he want the kingdom, and does he want the kingdom more than he wants Ram? When he came back to the kingdom, it was not that Bharat would have to live in the forest. Bharat was also part of the royal family. Bharat would also live in royal opulence. He would not be the king. That's all. So Ram tested that. And when Bharat passed the test, then Ram returned. So actually, this world is a testing ground for us. Just a few months ago, I was in Melbourne. So when I was giving a Bhagavatam class, one devotee asked the question, you know, if God wants us to make right choices, you know, why has he given so many wrong choices for us? The right choices appear to be so few, and the wrong choices are so many. So why has God given so many wrong choices? So I explained, you know, that is how it always is in any multiple choice exam. If you have a multiple choice exam, say 5 options are there, 4 options are wrong. It's only one option that is right. Now, if the correct choice depended simply on probability, then we could say the examiner is stacking the decks against us by giving so many wrong choices. But the right choice in an exam is not meant to be a function of probability alone. The teacher who is conducting the exam, the teacher also gives knowledge. And the student has studied and internalized the knowledge, then the student can make the right choice. So the exam is not meant to mislead the student by giving wrong choices. The exam is actually meant to help the student internalize the studies and express the internalization by making the right choices. The Vishnu Sahasranam has 1,000 names of Vishnu, which is recited famously by Bhishma, and before and after him also many sages have recited it. So among them, the two names are Kamadaha Kamyo. Kamadaha means, Baldev Vidya Bhushan in his commentary on the Vishnu Sahasranam says that you are the giver of desires. And also says Kamyah, you are the ultimate desirable object. So the Lord is the giver of desires, and he is himself the most desirable object. Now when we have a multiple choice exam, suppose there are 5 options. Now we can't choose a 6th option because there are only 5 options over there. Sometimes one of the options may be none of the above. But if there's no none of the above, then we just have to choose one among the 5 options. So similarly, sometimes people ask this question, is our free will really free? Especially when some people get addicted. Addiction is said to be a state where the desires become so strong that it is almost as if a person has lost their free will. Actually, we never lose our free will. But when addiction comes up, the desire becomes so irresistible, so uncontrollable, so subconsciously forceful that the person seems to have as if no choice. So do we really have free will? Or is it that our free will can be lost? Actually, all living beings have free will. What to speak of humans, even animals have free will. But the scope of their free will is very limited. Say, tomorrow is Ekadashi. Suppose a cat sees a rat on Ekadashi. The cat can't think, oh, today is Ekadashi, I should fast. The cat will immediately pounce on the rat. So the animals are simply driven by their biological drives. And they don't have much of a choice whether to act on those drives or not. So the desire comes within, the object is seen outside, they indulge in it. They try to get it. Now even within this, animals also have some free will. Say if a cow is grazing and the cow eats the grass over here. Now whether should the cow take the grass on the left side or on the right side? That's the free will. And based on the free will, it may choose, some cows may choose the left, some cows may choose the right. Now, the desire is there, the capacity to choose is there, but that capacity to choose is very limited. Not whether I should eat or should not eat grass. If the hunger is there, I have to eat. But okay, this should I eat this grass or that grass? So the free will is not taken away, but the scope of the free will is limited. Free will is there, but its scope is limited. So, yatha akash stito nityam vayu sarvatra gomaha tatha sarvani bhutani matsthani tyupadharaya. In 9.6 in the Bhagavata, Krishna says that just as the wind moves in the sky, similarly all living beings exist within me. Now, if you envision the sky as an upside down dome, then the wind can move freely within the sky, but the sky doesn't limit the movement of the air. The sky limits the area of movement. Within that area, the wind can move. Similarly, our desires themselves are not limited. The scope of our desires is limited by the way we have acted in the past. So when we get a particular body, at that time, the scope of our desires gets limited. Now, often we say that human body is special. It has the privilege of Brahma Jigyasa. We can do spiritual inquiry in the human body. Now, if you look at the body from the physical perspective or a material perspective, now where is the difference? The human body is made of the same elements as the animal body. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Again, mind, intelligence, ego is also the same. So where is the difference? The soul is also the same. It's not that the dramatically different soul in an animal body and a human body. The difference is actually in the subtle body. In the conditioning of the subtle body. So when a dog sees some food, the dog may salivate. When we humans see some food, we may also salivate. But in the subtle body, the intelligence is more developed. And therefore we can choose whether to act on our desires or to not act on our desires. And depending on how we use or don't use our free will properly, the scope of our free will can become restricted or expanded. So for example, if somebody is an alcoholic, if they have become addicted to alcohol, you know, their free will, it may seem as if they have no free will only. You know, they say, the only choice they can do is, you know, should I drink whiskey or should I drink brandy? They can't choose whether I should drink or not. They're bound by that. That is the nature of addiction. So what has happened? The free will is there, but the scope of the free will has become substantially reduced. So the desire itself, they have the capacity to desire, but the scope of the desires is limited. Now, when the scope is limited, even within that choice, we have some freedom. And that using the freedom that we have, that is vital for our spiritual, for our growth in any way. So suppose a person has had a fracture, and after the fracture, you know, so say their hand has been now cast, and then now they're told you have to exercise your hand. Suppose that person had been a bodybuilder earlier, but now the hand is so weak that they can't even lift their hand. He says, what exercise? You know, earlier I used to lift 30, 40 kg weight. Now I can't even lift my hand. What exercise can I do? So doctor may say, can you lift your finger? He says, yes, I can do that. He says, that is your exercise. Exercise? He says, what is this exercise? You know, this is not exercise. He says, no, this is the exercise for you. This is the exercise. Lift your finger. Just keep lifting one finger, whichever finger they can. Gradually, told, okay, you can lift your other fingers also. Then they can lift their hand. Then gradually they start lifting their forearm. Then they can lift their full arm. And like that, by starting with where one is, one can actually increase the strength in one's arm. And similarly, with respect to our desires, we have conditionings. Conditionings, what does the word conditioning mean? See, conditioning means that a certain condition is created inside us. Like we have air conditioning. Air conditioning means the air is made into at a particular temperature. The air is conditioned to be at a particular temperature. It operates at that condition. So conditioned soul means a soul who cannot operate without certain conditions. So if an alcoholic is conditioned by the addiction to alcohol, then the alcoholic feels, I just cannot live without alcohol. And that is the conditioning. So the conditioned soul needs certain conditions for functioning. They're actually not needs. In fact, for the alcoholic would be much happier if they stopped drinking alcohol. But still at that stage, it appears to them as if I can't live without it. They can't function without that condition. Now, it may be true also at that time that they cannot live without that particular object. When the desire comes, it appears irresistible. And we are told that we should separate between our desire, between our wants and our needs. But the nature of conditioning is that conditioning makes wants appear to be needs. When we are very strongly conditioned, then our wants appear to be needs. Alcoholic feels, I cannot live without alcohol. I just have to get it. So at that time, where is their freedom? So all of us, we may have, based on our attachment, we just feel, you know, too disturbed, too. If we are attached to something, we don't get that. We feel so agitated as if we can't do anything. So at that time, our freedom lies in between the occurrence of the desires. So when the alcoholic gets the urge to drink. And when that urge comes, it's almost impossible to give it up. And suppose that alcoholic is trying to recover. And when they're trying to give up the alcohol, and then that urge comes and they feel, oh, I can't live without it. And they go and drink it. And then they beat themselves up. Why did I do that? You know, I'm a fool. I'll never be able to give up alcohol. And they become disheartened. So the important thing is, when the if we consider our desires, if our desires that come in our consciousness, you know, the desires are not always intolerably strong. If we consider a graph of our desires, the desires shoot up sometimes. And when the desire shoots up, that is the time it appears intolerable. But after that desire has shot up, then even if we fall, even if we indulge, after that desire goes down. And then that spike may come again. So when we are very strongly conditioned by something, we may not be able to control the spikes. We may not even be able to control our behavior when the spikes come. But what about in between? In between, we have freedom. And if in between, we are acting soberly, we are trying to be as serious, as sober, as spiritual as possible, that will purify us. The mind is actually a very dangerous enemy. It is dangerous because it doesn't appear to be an enemy. It appears to be inside us, it appears to be like our friend. So, now, suppose somebody send a WhatsApp message to us. And that message contained a link. Now, we wouldn't immediately click on the link and start seeing what is there. Now, we'd first look at who has sent this message. And we'll think, what kind of messages does this person send? You know, if that person is known to send a lot of spam kind of messages, then we would not click at it. That means we look at the sender before we look at the message. So similarly, you know, just as when a click comes on the phone, when a link comes on our phone, we don't immediately click it. So I'm just currently writing a book on what your phone can teach you about your mind. So taking people's infatuation with the phone to explain. So like that, just as sometimes we can say when a desire comes in our consciousness, it's like a link which has come inside us. So just as somebody may send a link on our message, WhatsApp message. So like that, a link comes inside us. Okay, come on, why don't you do this? At that time, we don't have to click that. So look at the mind before you look with the mind. The mind is saying, come on, eat this. Come on, watch this. Come on, enjoy this. And who is saying this? That's not my desire. It's actually the mind's desire. And is it really important? So if you look at the mind, we introspect, we evaluate. I don't have to act on this desire. So actually, the mind, now if somebody else came and told us, you know, say if we are planning to diet, and then somebody came and told us, come on, eat this. No, I can't eat this, you know. We'll find out some reason to politely say no. But if same desire comes from inside us, why don't you eat this? Yeah, I will eat it. When the desire comes from inside, we actually lower our guard. Because when we talk about inside and outside, you know, we often still operate on the body-based paradigm. From the body's perspective, what somebody else come and telling me, why don't you eat this? That is from outside. And the desire coming from inside me, that is inside. I think this is my desire. But if you understand I am the soul, from the soul's perspective, even the mind is external. So the mind's desire is not the soul's desire. So the mind's desire is like, say, on a computer, sometimes if I'm surfing some page, suddenly a window pops up. Now the window has popped up on the page that I was reading, but I didn't cause that to pop up. It just popped up over there. So just because it has popped up on the page on which I'm browsing, that doesn't mean I have to click it and I have to read that page. You know. So similarly, the mind is external to us. And just because some desire pops up in the mind, we don't have to act on that desire. We can say no to it. Even if the desire comes inside, still we can say no. That's what Krishna tells in 2.17 to Arjuna. Apuryamanam achala pratishtam samudrama apah pravishanti advat. Tadvat kamayam pravishanti sarve sashanti mapnoti na kama kami. So the example that is given is just as rivers flow into an ocean, similar desires flow into the consciousness of a self-realized person, but the self-realized person is not disturbed. This is a very significant verse because it concludes with this word, kama kami. It's an interesting double word, compound word. Kama kami, literally, na kama kami, Krishna says. Kama kami means the desirer of desire. This is an interesting concept. The desirer of desire means, normally we think of desires as flowing outside. I see a particular object and I desire that object. But Krishna talks here about river flowing into the ocean. That means he's talking about desire flowing into us. What this means is, he's saying sometimes some objects which induce desire, they pop in, they come into us. But we don't have to become a desirer of desire. The desire has come inside me, but I don't have to accept that desire as my desire and act on it. So Krishna says, don't be a desirer of desire. The desire has come inside from somewhere. It can come from external observation or stimuli, or it can come from some past impression which just the recollection comes up and the desire comes in. Either way, just because the desire has come, I don't have to accept that desire as my desire. We don't have to be a desirer of desire. Now, the more attached, if we are not attached to something, then when the desire comes, hey, where did this desire come from? I don't want to think like this. We are appalled sometimes by the kind of desire that come inside us. And you say, I don't want this desire. And we push it away. We try to think about Krishna. We try to get engaged in something constructive. And we drive the desire out. Actually, we can't literally drive the desire out. No desire can be driven out. Because desire is not a tangible thing that we can push out. You know, if some unwanted person has come into our house, we may evict that person. But desires can't be evicted. Desires can only be crowded out. Just like if there is darkness in a room, I can't say, darkness, go away. I can't shout at the darkness. I can't curse the darkness. I have to actually turn on the light. When I turn on the light, darkness automatically goes away. So like that, when some unhealthy desire has come inside us, the way to deal with that desire is not to think why this desire is there, how can I get it out? No, turn the thoughts towards something constructive. Fill the consciousness with Krishna, with service to Krishna, with some constructive engagement. That's like turning on the light. When the light is turned on, then the desire is crowded out. So the desires cannot be evicted, but they can be crowded out when something else fills our consciousness. Now this is, in general, the way to deal with very, very strange kind of desire that come inside us. But sometimes some desires which you are habituated to, which you are addicted to, we may not even realize, oh, that desire has come and now I'm acting on it. So what happens? The mind is a dangerous enemy because it doesn't seem like an enemy. It is right inside us. But the mind is dangerous for another reason. See, first, the mind makes us do wrong. You know, come on, do this, eat this, watch this, touch this, do this. It just goads us to do it. And after we do it, first the mind makes us a criminal, and then it becomes a judge who punishes the criminal. You fool, why did you do that? So many times you made a resolution. You are good for nothing. You are useless. You have fallen down, now stay fallen. So what the mind does is, we may fall down, but we don't have to stay fallen. When that desire spike comes up, at that time, it might just be impossible to resist it. But what after that? When the desire spike comes, the mind makes us do wrong. But after that desire spike has gone away, after that, the mind keeps beating us up. You know, you fool, you good for nothing. You are a sense gratifier, you are this, you are that. And at that time also, we stay mind conscious. We don't become Krishna conscious. Although we may say this is guilt and this is good. Oh, I'm feeling bad that I did that wrong thing. But you know, the purpose of guilt is to come, if I am here, Krishna is here and some wrong... Okay. If I am here, so Krishna is here and some wrongdoing is here. Guilt is meant to come here between me and the wrongdoing. But when the mind beats us up, that is coming between us and Krishna. That is not guilt, that is pseudo-guilt. Anything that keeps us away from Krishna is actually Maya, it's temptation. So even if our guilt is discouraging us in our practice of bhakti, then we should see that guilt also is Maya. Not that we should not feel bad if we have done something wrong, but that bad feeling should make us take shelter of Krishna, not make us go away from Krishna. If we become disheartened in our bhakti, then that feeling of disheartenment, that guilt which is coming, that is actually Maya. So the mind first makes us do wrong and then beats us down for doing wrong. And both ways, we stay mind conscious instead of being Krishna conscious. And then when we stay mind conscious, we are actually becoming weaker and weaker. So the desire spike has come. Afterwards, we are simply beating ourselves up. Next time when the desire spike comes, we are still disheartened and again we succumb. But if the desire spike comes, at that time we may fall. But then after that, what do? If after that we are seriously practicing bhakti, becoming Krishna conscious, staying Krishna conscious, then next time the desire spike comes, even at that time it may be difficult to resist. But if in between we are consistently practicing Krishna bhakti, we are becoming stronger. We are becoming stronger. And eventually, we will be able to better resist the desires. So the desire spike will become more and more manageable as we become stronger by our bhakti practice. So that is actually one understanding of this verse. Apichetsu duracharo bhajate mamananya bhak. Sadhureva samantavya samyag vyavasito hisaha. See, even if my devotee commits terribly wrong, terrible activities, still the devotee is to be considered saintly if they are fixed in their determination. Now we may wonder over there, you know, if somebody is fixed in their determination to practice bhakti, how can they commit wrong? Doesn't the fixity in practicing bhakti means that they will not commit wrong? What it means is that even if they commit wrong, they don't give up their determination to practice bhakti. So if we stay fixed in the practice of bhakti, gradually kshipram bhavati dharmatma shashvat shantim nigacchati. Next verse 9.31, Krishna says, soon the person will become pure. Dharmatma will become virtuous. That's why no matter whatever happens, we never give up the practice of Krishna bhakti. We keep practicing Krishna bhakti no matter how much we have difficulties in dealing with our conditionings. And by this consistent practice of Krishna bhakti, gradually we'll become purer and stronger. So that means that if we consider, again going back to the example of the multiple choice exam, sometimes when elections are there, the elections are rigged. So a person goes and tries to press this button on the cursor, but the other button gets pressed. You know, that sometimes happens. And then, you know, I didn't choose this, I wanted to choose this. How did this get chosen? So it's almost something like that may happen sometimes when the conditioning is very strong. We want to do one thing, but something else gets done. But at that time, the choice may almost seem not to be with us. But afterwards, during the spikes, we have choice. That time, if we keep making the right choices, we are becoming stronger. And by making the right choices when we can, gradually, Krishna will help us make the right choices when we can't. There are times when the conditioning may be so strong that I feel I can't make the right choice. But don't worry too much about that right now. Make the right choices when we can. And the more when we make, more we do what we can do, the more Krishna helps us to do what we can't do. But unfortunately, what happens is we just think, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. And by thinking that I can't do this, we don't do what we can do also. So that we have to avoid. So Bharat was so pure that he had no desire for the kingdom at all. And he just gave Ram the kingdom as soon as Ram returned. He was delighted. So he chose Ram over the kingdom. Similarly, when the temptations come in our life, you know, kamada kamyo, the desire, Krishna is the giver of desire, but Krishna is also the giver of the knowledge of which, what is the most desirable object. And Krishna himself is the most desirable object. So when we choose Krishna, we can actually say no to our conditionings. So the focus in bhakti should not be on saying no to things. The focus should always be on saying yes to Krishna. If I keep trying to say yes to Krishna, the no will come automatically. If I focus on saying no is never pleasurable. Whenever I say no to something, you know, there's a sense of deprivation, there's a sense of loss. And if you define our bhakti by saying, based on saying no to something, then we will not be able to get the conviction to say no. So if you focus on saying yes to Krishna, yes, this is what I want to do for Krishna, then gradually we'll be able to overcome whatever strong desires may come also. And for saying yes to Krishna, I'll conclude with this point, that you know, there are many services that we can do in Krishna bhakti, and there is our sadhana, there is our allocated service, all that is important, and we should do that. At the same time, we can be looking, while practicing bhakti, to find out what it is that enables us to strongly connect with Krishna. Just as we all have sensual stimuli. So different people, so for an alcoholic, you know, just seeing any bottle, that may remind them of alcohol. So they have that stimuli which reminds them of their indulgence. So just as we have sensual stimuli, so like that there are spiritual stimuli. And the spiritual stimulus in the language of the Bhaktisamrita Sindhu is called as Uddipan. Uddipan is that which stimulates thoughts and emotions about Krishna inside our heart. And so all of us, we are all individuals. And just as in with respect to Maya, there are different things which stimulate us materially, sensually. What stimulates me sensually may not be the same as what stimulates you sensually. So, and whatever it is, we have to be cautious about our particular sensual stimuli. Similarly, for us, for different devotees, spiritual stimuli may be different. So what may be my spiritual stimuli may not be your spiritual stimuli. So we have to find out what is our Uddipan. What enables us to get quickly absorbed in Krishna. And we try to maximize that. So, I find that when I take darshan of the deities, if I don't recite any verse at that time, I just can't connect. So I try to memorize verses and recite verses in front of the deities. And I feel, oh, this verse, this Lord whom I'm describing, with, who's glorified in this verse, that same Lord is present over here. Then I feel some devotional connection. So once I spoke in a class that, you know, we can recite verses when we take darshan of the deities. After a couple of days, one devotee came and told me, he says, you told we should recite verses, but when I go in front of the deities, earlier I used to feel so devotional. But now, when I go in front of the deities and try to recollect a verse, that recollecting that causes so much tension that whatever bhakti is there goes away. So, what this means is, I realize that his Uddipan is different from my Uddipan. So, for me, memorizing shlokas and reciting shlokas is Uddipan. For him, that is not a Uddipan, that is a tension. So, we have to find out what is a Uddipan for us. And we try to maximize that. Some devotees can sing kirtans in such intricate, complex tunes that kirtan is more of a performance than a participation. It's marvelous to see. They can get absorbed, but others may not find it easy, so easy to absorb in that kirtan. So we have to find out what is our Uddipan and maximize our exposure to that. So if there's a particular picture of the deities which we feel very attracted to, then we keep it in our phone with us. And whenever we feel agitated or we feel disconnected from Krishna, we can pray to that picture. Or if there are some devotees' lectures which we like to hear, then always keep them accessible. if there are some sentences from scripture which strike us very much. So all of us, if we take responsibility for increasing our connection with Krishna, the process of bhakti will definitely increase our attraction to Krishna. But additionally, based on our understanding of our own nature, we take responsibility for filling our consciousness with Krishna. Then if we can find out what is our uddipan, then based on that uddipan, we can easily connect with Krishna. And that uddipan becomes a very easy source of spiritual desire for us. And when the spiritual desire comes in, as I said, the material desire can be crowded out. So if you focus on learning what our uddipans are and maximizing our exposure to the uddipan, then the spiritual desires within us will increase, and those spiritual desires will crowd out the worldly desires. And that's how we will be able to choose Krishna more and more. I'll summarize. I talked about how to deal with desires on the spiritual path. Discuss how Bharat, he unhesitatingly, wholeheartedly chose Ram instead of the kingdom. He accepted the responsibility of the service of ruling the kingdom, but he did not take the privileges. So when we are dealing with our desires, we often find that the negative desires are more than the positive desires. It's like a multiple choice exam. And the whatever desires come in the multiple choice, the wrong options that come, they are based on our conditionings, the kind of choices we have made in the past, the kind of habits we have made. But our free will is never taken away. Even animals have free will. Their free will is simply to choose to eat this grass or that grass. We humans have the free will to choose. Should I eat or should I not eat? When we are conditioned that or we are addicted, that means the choice is very much restricted. So it may appear as if I don't have any choice at all. But just like a person who has no strength, they also have the strength to just lift up their finger, if not their hand. So like that, within whatever addiction we have, whatever attachment we have, we still have free will. And what we do within that scope, that is important. So sometimes the desires may surge up. That time it may be impossible to resist. But in between the surges of desires, what do we do? The mind makes us do wrong and then beats us up for doing wrong. So we have to avoid being mind conscious. So just because a desire pops up within me, that is not my desire. Krishna says, don't be a desirer of desire. Just because a link comes on my WhatsApp message, I don't click it immediately. So like that, we don't act on the desires when they come up in the mind. But even if we have to act because of the force of the conditioning, after that desire passes, what do? Rather than becoming disheartened, we focus on connecting with Krishna. And by staying connected with Krishna during the phases between the desires, that's like doing the exercise when we can. By that, we will become stronger and stronger. And eventually, what seemed impossible, lifting up the hand was impossible, but that also becomes possible. Like that, resisting the desires, even in the surge up, that will become possible. And desires cannot be driven out, they have to be crowded out. And for crowding out lower desires, we need to find out our own uddipan, our own spiritual stimulus, that which kindles spiritual thoughts and spiritual emotions within us, and maximize our exposure to that. So when spiritual desires come by that exposure, then worldly desires can be resisted and driven out. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna.